Welcome to Idle Redheads, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Redheads. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle.
All right, so the big news, which will probably be several days old by the time this uploads, is D&D Next, or D&D 5th Edition, got announced with release dates and cover previews and a little bit of details about what's going to be in each of the big three core books and the starter set.
Yeah.
Well, you got your finger on the pulse of internet hate, Wayne.
And he's also the senior of it, yeah?
Yeah, if by being on Twitter, then yes, I guess I do.
So what's the Twitterverse saying?
I don't know. There's a lot of positivity. A couple people, you know, talking about how 4E is officially dead now, which has been dead for a while, in my opinion. But, yeah. I don't know. Kind of...
Was there some news about 4E being officially killed, or is that...
No, I mean, that's what people are saying, because Now, you know, here we have street dates of the next edition, so, you know.
Okay. Well, like the reason that, I ask it. Is because when I logged onto the Wizards site to look at the previews of the Player's Handbook and whatnot, they still have the old D&D Insider toolbox and subscription up on the side, so I was wondering, that all those 4E tools, I wonder if they, really, those are still alive. I'm surprised.
Well, yeah, I don't know. They probably won't take them down, you know, for a while.
Well, I mean, because I suppose if people are still playing 4E, then keep them up, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that is one of the things about role-playing games, is they never really go bad. You know, you can, as long, until your book falls apart, you can keep playing it. Yeah. But
some may start bad, but they never go bad.
Yeah. But I doubted that, you know, Wizards of the Coast would take down everything and then still have a couple months of nothing up there. Yeah. Because Player's Handbook isn't going to get released until, like, August 19th, which is fairly late.
Yeah, it's still quite a bit away.
Yeah. The starter box is going to get released sometime late July, so they'll have something ready for that. But between then and now, I think they have a couple adventures coming up between then and now, but it's not like you want to have nothing.
Yeah, the starter box is the middle of July. Player's Handbook is in August, of course, in time for Gen Con. Yeah, and then they have two adventures, one in August and one in October.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Interesting that the Player's Handbook is coming in August, but the Dungeon Master's Guide isn't coming until November.
Well, Mike Merle said the reason for that was they just can't release the three books all at once.
Mm-hmm.
He referred to all the errata that came after 4E was released. And that makes sense. I mean, you have a deadline, a publishing deadline. You're going to push it to the deadline.
Right.
And I'd rather them go, you know, we just can't do the three books, or, you know, they're going to be mistakes, because you have like that late edit and that's got a domino effect and you can't catch it, you know, so they're like, you know, we can manage one book, and if they can do that and have very few mistakes in that one book, then I'm fine with waiting a few months to get the complete three.
Oh yeah, I agree completely. It's better that they wait and turn out a better product than rush it and turn out something crap.
But also, I mean, people are talking about the price of $50.
Yeah, $50 for each book, yeah.
Yeah, for each core book. But, I mean, you get the Player's Handbook, you have a chance to look at it, to see, do you like this edition or this version of Dungeons & Dragons? And you got a $50 commitment, but you don't have a $150 commitment.
Hmm.
No, I like the slipcase. I bought 4E, bought the set of three.
Actually, by that logic, you could also buy the starter set first, too, at only $20, and then kind of see if it's something, a game that you like before going in for the $50 Player's Handbook as well.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really good point, and I think it was a combination of them needing to release something early, I think, to maintain interest and momentum. But yeah, it also is, you know, less than half the price of either of those three books. So yeah, get people to start playing, and the starter set lets you play characters up to level 5, kind of like the old, you know, original D&D. So
yeah. Well, I think this, fair enough, maybe get something before Gen Con to whet people's appetite for the Gen Con releases. But a starter set should be for people that are unfamiliar with D&D, a kind of a jump on,
right,
as opposed to being unfamiliar with an edition.
I
think people who are familiar with D&D will buy it, will buy the starter set, but I think the Player's Handbook would be the true test of whether or not you're going to like this edition.
Yeah, I mean, for myself, I think I'm going to buy it. Just $20, that's enough for me to jump in. And that's really saying something, because I usually will only buy a game after having tried it out and having a commitment to play. But I'm interested enough. I want to see how this looks, and I want to see how they present it, too. Because, I mean, for what it's worth, I still think of D&D as kind of the flagship of the RPG hobby. So I'm hoping that it's a good system.
Yeah, I completely agree that D&D is the flagship of the hobby, or at least the, you know, the primary gateway to the hobby. And yeah, I think it's smart for them to put out the starter set, because as Lyle said, that's the one that people who are unfamiliar with the game or role-playing games in general are going to pick up. So make that as accessible as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're not going to pick up the big 320-page, $50 player's handbook. I mean, you will. That's something that someone who is already familiar with the hobby and probably D&D is going to pick up.
But, exactly, yeah.
You mentioned, you know, internet hate. A couple people mentioned that there was no mention of any kind of PDF versions of the books. Nothing like that. Who knows what Wizards of the Coast is going to do in the future, but currently that's the way it looks. Physical copies only.
Hmm. Well, if they only make physical copies, somebody else will make a PDF within
minutes.
Well,
yeah,
so.
yeah.
What? Huh? Yeah, a little side note. What do you think would be distributed quicker, an official PDF or a pirated scanned PDF?
Doesn't matter. But the same, you know. All it takes is one dishonest person to copy it, one or the other.
Right.
I guess it makes no difference.
Mm. Yeah, but kind of like we discussed before. Like, if the legitimate copy is easy to access, then I think there are people who would definitely buy it rather than get the pirated copy.
Yeah, no, I guess from the survey that we talked about a few episodes ago, and people said that most people prefer to print copies, so maybe this is what's important to you, so here's the print copy.
Right.
And then the PDF details will be released later. Mm. But yeah, as you said, also people indicated that, or well, we discussed in the episode, that if you price it low enough, people will pay for it as opposed to pirating it.
Right.
Because people seem to be reluctant to pirate, but not a complete aversion to it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
So yeah. make it easier than to not pirate. But yeah, again, I'm excited because of the books. I didn't even notice that they didn't have the PDF listed. I was just looking at the book.
Well,
and the information there.
I don't know. That doesn't really matter to me either way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but you're right, Lyle. The iTunes and the Netflix business model does work. If it's easy enough and cheap enough, people will buy it online rather than pirate. So.
And this is also goes back to what we discussed in the survey episodes, but maybe they're releasing something really special for the digital media.
Maybe.
True. Well, they had,
maybe not.
For 4E, they had that compendium thing, which is basically the same as like the online SRD, but you could only have that through a subscription.
Right.
So, yeah. I don't know. I don't think there was a 4E SRD, at least not an official one, but I'm not sure.
I mean, there's a few things they could be doing. I mean, they could just release the regular PDF as formatted, like the book.
Hmm.
So, not a big deal. And they're just kind of deciding what to price it, or they could be trying to experiment with it a little bit and seeing if it works before they announce something, because that did come back to bite them a little bit in 4E, where they perhaps oversold what D&D Insider would be.
Very true.
But what do you guys think? I think the cover art is really good. I mean, it seems to be very 2D-esque or first edition with a little bit of second edition.
Yeah.
Combination.
It reminds me of the Rules Cyclopedia, the old D&D compilation.
Yes.
Set.
Yeah.
And
The black books that came out in second edition.
Yeah.
But that's what I started with. Yeah. Hmm. What's that? Jeff Easley, I think. Did the cover illustrations for the players, or the big three for revised second edition?
Sorry, but, don't know.
I might be wrong. Who knows? But I don't know. I like them better than the blocky anime style of 4th edition. But they look okay. I think the red slash down at the bottom with very small Dungeons & Dragons is a bit odd.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's unified across all the books, but I don't know.
They seem to be really committing to the D&D.
Mm.
Mm.
so we see that, like, committing to Dungeons & Dragons with 3rd edition instead of the advanced and whatever, right. You know, so streamlined. I mean, that's a good choice. And now really going with the D&D. Yeah, but it is tiny. I think, and that's what they're doing is they've got the tiny Dungeons & Dragons, but the D&D is not that much bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And very secondary to the Dungeon Master's Guide. So it almost doesn't look like a cover.
Right, right.
Yeah, it looks almost like a boilerplate page.
Yeah.
Mm.
So that's interesting. I probably would make the D&D a little bit bigger if I were the... Yeah, but maybe they're like, we want the picture to really sell it.
Yeah.
Right. Certainly, it's not crowding out the picture. And the pictures are really good.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I think I was... I agree with you, Wayne, that I like the style of 3 and 3.5 better, but these are really, really good paintings.
Oh, yeah. It's great. It's great art.
I really like the starter set. I think that's... you know, you got the massive dragon and the tiny, tiny fighter. And
this picture shows you are screwed.
Yeah,
or does it? You're playing D&D. You know, you're probably gonna beat that dragon if the dungeon master stated it correctly.
It's exciting. It's a little bit simpler, in my opinion, than the other covers that we see. But certainly, I think that's what you need for the starter set, or somebody who wouldn't know what a beholder is, which is on the Monster Manual. But and that, of course, is a great cover.
Yeah.
And Wayne was complaining about how busy the Player's Handbook is.
Only because the first picture I saw was a tiny little thumbnail, and I'm like, couldn't figure out what was going on in that thing. I'm like, is that big guy there, the player race?
With the red eyes.
Yeah, yeah. I was like, very odd choice. What race is that?
Yeah. What about the guy with the skull head?
Yeah, Skeletor. I didn't know you could play Skeletor in D&D.
Oh, I want to play a skull head guy.
Yeah, of course you would.
I said that for you, Wayne.
Well, we'll get a chance to play when you buy it, Chris.
Yeah, I hope so. And I hope that they have a PDF version so that you guys can see it, because we don't often get to play in the same room.
Mm.
So this episode will be our next installment of Rogues. And for people not familiar with that series, it's where we look at a particular type of crime or criminal. And we talk about, or we go through 4 questions. What is it? Who does it? Why do they do it? And how do they do it? And in this episode, we'll look at The Fixer. I suppose the more recent inspiration for this topic comes from Ray Donovan, The Fixer, which is a TV series that I believe in North America is on Showtime.
Yes, yes.
But it's on one of the cable channels here in Japan, and it just started. And Wayne and I have been watching, or have watched a few episodes of it.
Right.
And that just kind of sparked, we haven't done The Fixer yet, so let's do that.
There's another recent series that came out, too, in the same thing. I think it's called Scandalous, maybe, or Scandal.
Scandal.
Yeah, the main character is Olivia Pope. So, I don't know, maybe it's something that's hot in the media right now, that the fixer.
I think she's more of a political fixer.
Mm-hmm.
And Ray Donovan is what they would call a Hollywood fixer.
Mm-hmm.
So since we're talking about it, what is the crime of fixing?
Well, actually, you know, it took me a little while to find the definition. The first thing I found was more kind of like a person who fixes you up with a job. And that was the term that I originally knew it with from things like Cyberpunk and Shadowrun.
Hmm.
But in this sense, the fixer is more a person who fixes a problem that's already happened. You know, I think the first example that I found of Ray Donovan was a Hollywood star wakes up to find a dead hooker in his bed and needs to call Ray to figure out what to do about it.
Right. Yeah. That's a good example, yeah.
Exactly the one I was going to use, yeah.
Dead hookers, you know.
Yep.
So, yeah, the fixer is actually a combination of a few crimes. Of course, they can fix things legitimately, but that would be boring.
Also, kind of fix a Rogues episode.
Yeah. So they use things like blackmail, bribes, intimidation...
Assassination.
Yeah, and also killing, as well as they can kind of clean up a scene. And that gets into a very famous fixer, the wolf from Pulp Fiction.
Yeah, or the cleaner from Femme Nikita.
Yeah, Stephen King had a part in Sons of Anarchy as a cleaner.
Oh,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, it's pretty creepy.
this is a very specialized fixer, but we don't imagine that we're going to do an entire episode on the cleaner. and what cleansing products they use. And it's the best way to...
It would be a lot of how you do it as opposed to what do you do, because the what would just be you dispose of dead bodies.
Right.
And now let's talk about all the ways to do that.
You want to get some good bleach.
Yeah. What kind of drains do you have in your house? Yeah. So we thought we would take the fixer and we would talk about, in particular, the blackmail, the bribery, the cleaning, as well as the intimidation. We're not going to talk about the killing because we do think that we could talk about someone who kills, such a contract killer, an assassin, in a future episode.
Mm-hmm. Oh, plus, again, it'd be a lot of how, because what do? You kill people. Okay. Right, that's the what.
Well, if you boil everything, bribery, what do? You give people money. All right, well, that's done.
All right, fair enough.
What does the fixer do? Well, he fixes problems. All right, cool.
Yeah. Okay, what? Check. We've already covered Ray Donovan as a fictional one. Check. There's the who. Right. Why do they do it? I'm guessing it's a job, so money.
All right. Why don't you just boil the whole episode down?
You could release a series called The Wayne Notes of our episodes.
3-minute episode.
I think I'm going to do that, The Wayne Notes. Yeah, just read The Wayne Notes. Yeah, basically, it's anybody who kind of works. It's kind of like a gray area. You can go through legal channels, or you can go through illegal channels to fix a problem. And as we were discussing before the episode, like, it doesn't only have to be illegitimate or illegal things. It could be where a problem is, or an issue you have is fairly complex. It would require you going through a lot of channels, going to see a lot of people, and it might be easier to go to this one person and kind of pay them to do everything necessary. Like, again, to use a Ray Donovan example, was adoption. So rather than go through a whole bunch of legal channels, or go see a whole bunch of people, lawyers and whatnot, to get this done, or instead of the person themselves going to talk to the biological mother and getting them to waive their rights, just pay this one guy and he'll take care of everything.
Sounds illegal.
Well, okay.
The way you've described that sounds kind of illegal.
Fair enough.
There's certainly a legal way to adopt somebody.
Right.
But that sounds like they did it.
Yeah, usually paying a guide, isn't that?
Well, it was kind of gray, but like they actually did then go to a lawyer and get all these papers written up, and mm-hmm. then it's like, all you have to do is sign here.
Right. Just before we get into further in this episode, we should just say that the Rogues episodes are intended for mature listeners. So we may cover situations and crimes that might not be suitable for all listeners.
It's a lot of nudity in Ray Donovan.
No, certainly the example I want to talk about. Right. It wouldn't be suitable for all listeners. Since we're talking about adoption, I was thinking about, for example, if you have a married politician who gets a campaign aide pregnant, the fixer might talk to them and persuade them that it would be better if they got an abortion. Mm-hmm. And that would be a fixer. So it's not bribery, it's not blackmail, or intimidation, it's persuasion. So there's certainly legal channels or legal ways to do it.
Right.
That's one of the things that actually I thought was really interesting about the way that the fixers work is that, with so many kind of rogue crimes, they are crimes, they're illegal, but yeah, the fixer can span the whole breadth from black to gray to white. It generally tends to stick in the gray and black, of course, they're free to use any channel that they want to. I think one of the most common examples was just paying off lawyers and judges, which of course is illegal, but it's kind of working within the legal system to clean things up. So
I guess,
again, a shaky grasp of what is legal.
Of course it is illegal, but it's still working within the system.
Yeah, it's like, here's this giant loophole in the system.
It's not, it's breaking the system.
It's literally saying, I see your system over here. I'm going to go around it.
He killed the witnesses, therefore there was nobody to testify against his client, so
exactly,
it was within the system. Cross-examination, killing them, same.
But
you've done this before.
I think that's a good point, Chris, because for some reason I was thinking of the Hackers episode, and it's like a white hat or a gray hat or a black hat. You're pretty much one of those choices, right? But the fixer, you could lean more illegal or legal, but I think due to the nature of the job, you would have more leeway in what you did for any one particular fixer.
Well, you know, actually, that was a point that I was thinking about with it. I haven't thought it through that much, so I'm not sure if I'm right on it or not. But, you know, with the other rogues that we've talked about, we talked about, for example, smugglers and hackers, and there's some of them can work, you know, for the people, for the good. Smugglers can help out impoverished communities that are maybe under military rule, or there can be white hat hackers. So you can have good intentions, but still be doing it through an illegal trade. Whereas for the fixers, I think usually their intentions are usually pretty bad, because people could otherwise choose to go through regular legal channels. Right. The thing is that the tools they use can span from the black to the white. So maybe, like I said, I hadn't really thought of it through that much.
But. Well, no, I kind of see what you're saying.
We normally discuss the who before the why, but it sounds like we're covering motivation right now, so let's do the why. Why would you be a fixer? So Chris has made the distinction where there's the white, gray, and black methods. But people normally associate those shades with motivation.
Well, of course, if you're reading the Wayne notes, then the answer would just be money, because you know that's the only reason people would do crimes, pretty much. But I don't know the why people would become a fixer. I mean, I guess one of the reasons, and again, this kind of breaks Chris's tenuous grasp of how the legal system works, is you've seen that the legal system is broken. And, you know, you feel that justice isn't served. And so, I mean, this kind of becomes a little bit of kind of a vigilante, but you are willing to, fix problems however possible to help people.
Yeah, you know, actually, as I was saying it, I thought of an example of the opposite, which is that Leverage TV series.
Yeah.
People who have been wrongly accused or committed of a crime, then they help them out of it.
Yeah, sure. Or if Ray Donovan were made in the 80s, then he would be helping old ladies and that and fixing their problems.
Right.
Perhaps with blackmail, bribery, and intimidation.
Right. And then the old lady come and pays him with a gigantic jar full of pennies.
Or a kiss on the cheek.
Yeah.
Oh, jeez.
And then he walks into the sunset.
It'd be pretty lame.
No, I think in addition to money or a twisted sense of justice, the motivation could also be they want to rub elbows or rub shoulders with the elite in society, and this is their in. So you can imagine that story, growing up in the rough side in New York. I think there's a few rough sides, actually, but
every side's probably rough.
Yeah, and, you know, idolizing Hollywood stars, and then they travel to Los Angeles, and they're a Hollywood fixer. They're now a private investigator, and they are fixing things for the Hollywood stars, but they get to hang out with Hollywood stars. Mm-hmm. Or, if not the A-list, you know, maybe the D-list. But that's close enough for them. And then when the A-list really has a problem, they contact them, and then they interact quickly. Somebody who idolizes a particular politician, they get to be not in the... sort of the inner circle when no one else is looking, but the outer circle when everybody else is looking, but they're there, you know, they're in that orbit.
No, that's a good point, because I was thinking it could be, as you said, a very narcissistic or self-centered motivation where I need or I want these people to rely on me because I need that attention, and so I'm going to make sure that I am able to solve these people's problems because, you know, the political person or the Hollywood star.
Wow, that's a proper sociopath right there.
Yeah, the political person or the Hollywood star, you know, when they crash and burn, they're going to have to come to me.
Is that a sociopath?
I don't know.
I think it's a very normal emotion to have. You need to feel needed,
right?
Oh yeah, bribing people and blackmailing people to get satisfaction of it, though,
or working a dead end job that sucks your soul out, and then you do that just so you can provide money to support your family because you want to feel needed by your family. I don't know. Yeah.
All right, well, we're not doing rogues wage slaves here.
That's a future episode. Yeah. Maybe a creature feature instead. But
why would you do that job? Why would you do it?
But, I mean, I didn't think of it just now, but a really twisted fixer could then orchestrate problems so that the people kept coming back.
Well, you know, actually, after you mentioned that, when I thought of an idea of someone who maybe really dislikes politicians or dislikes Hollywood stars, and in that kind of job, you get to hear all the dirt. You have the ability to bring people down, too, if you want.
That's a very good point.
And earn money while doing it. But, you know, another way you could look at it, too, is it's not just money, but it's also a lot of power. You know everybody's dirty little secrets. You know all the skeletons in their closets. I mean, that's a lot of power to carry around.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, you could combine that with the, you know, the taking them down is that whenever you do a job, you keep all the evidence.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yep.
So you go up to clean up the scene. Like the one of the examples is Marilyn Monroe's suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody was sent in to clean up that scene. So perhaps there was something else that was going on, or at least that's the allegation.
Mm-hmm.
But you keep all the evidence of what you supposedly cleaned up.
Yeah, or
then you keep that until you need it.
Yep, you keep just enough so that, you know, if anyone tries to blackmail you, you know, any of your clients blackmail you, you can say, yeah, that's really not a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if they were a sociopath, like Chris is suggesting, and then they try to, like, break away or distance themselves. So let's say you got that politician into power, and now they've got increased scrutiny, so they're trying to put some distance between themselves and you, then you can say, no, you're not going anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know. Tell me that you love me.
Yeah, then you become the blackmailer. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, so a lot of motivations. Or you could just be nihilistic, and you want to, I mean, like, you could be fixing things just to destroy them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, getting the wrong person in power.
Yeah, it might be a little on the cheesy side, but you could actually play, I suppose, a good fixer who really wants to help people, but they just haven't had any luck with the doing it through legal channels, or maybe they came from a rough background, so they're more experienced through the illegal means.
Right. Well, I was thinking that you mentioning, you know, the possibility, or at least the option that fixers have of going through the legal channels, like, I don't know how long you could play it that way, but you could exploit the legal system or without actually breaking it. Like, you could tie people up with, you know, court procedures or do things like that that aren't illegal but are still maybe a little bit dubious and mm-hmm. be good. Again, that there's probably only so many things you can do, which is exactly why people go to fixers, because, you know, the legal system has kind of failed. But you could do that as well, kind of playing on the, if you wanted to be a completely good fixer.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Well, I don't know if you needed, I'm tying up, like, people with court dates. Again, I think the method and the motivation aren't in sync. So, for example, you could have a completely good fixer who has to do everything illegally to fix the injustices in the world, right?
Right.
Mm.
You could have a completely evil fixer who is able to manipulate, not break the legal system to serve their client's ends, and that would be like the high-priced attorney who, and a good example is in the GURPS Rogues book, where the person's an attorney for the UFO Illuminati.
Okay.
And they look for people who have evidence on the UFOs, and then they try to get those, like, try to discredit them in court.
Right, right.
So there's somebody with a very bad motivation, using a supposedly very white method in order to do that. If you have somebody who's, I mean, if a corporation can get fixers.
Right.
To do it, mobsters can get like the attorney fixer to use completely
legal means
to destroy somebody or to achieve their ends.
Yeah, I remember I knew a lawyer back at a job I used to work at a long time ago, and he helped out a motorcycle gang with some kind of charge or something. And it was like he wasn't doing anything illegal; he was actually defending them because they paid him to do so. But like when it was all over, they came back to him and said, "Hey, you ever need somebody dragged behind a motorcycle for a while? Just let us know."
Right.
Kind of. Yeah. You know, touching that dark world.
Any people you know disappeared mysteriously, Chris?
Too many. Too many.
You've already said too much.
Exactly.
And then you talk about the other currency. Like, or I guess it is power, but like the favors.
Yeah.
So you're almost like...
I guess that's another motivation, because we've talked about having these people kind of in your pocket, or just the favors that these people could grant you could be a motivation, you know? kind of you've grown accustomed to a certain lifestyle and fixing these people's problems. Yeah, the money is good, but it's the other kind of favors they give you that kind of make it worth your while.
Yeah.
I mean, you could be like a drug addict. You could have a taste for a certain type of woman or man, and you need to acquire them illegally, you know, through prostitution or something like that. And then, you know, these favors can help you, you know, feed that habit.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you're almost like a favor bank. You're banking all these favors because you know somebody else can come in, and then you can parlay the favors that you have for even greater return.
So. Right. Absolutely.
You're a favor investor.
Yeah.
And you know, that's we only touched on it very briefly, but that's not to belittle money either. I mean, that's probably the prime motivator for a lot of people. I think one of the people, real life people, who the Ray Donovan character was based on, Anthony Pellicino, some of the things he was investigated for, never convicted though, was blackmailing people who were his targets. As in, someone would hire him to get information on another person, and he would go to that other person and say, "Hey, give me 100,000 yen, and I'll tell you who's trying to find out information on you." 100,000 yen, $100,000.
Well, since you again. Preempt the question, Chris. So who are these people? Who are these fixers? Are they real world or fictional fixers? We talked about Ray Donovan and Anthony Pellegrino.
Mm-hmm. Pellicano, I think.
Pellicano. And I guess his mentor was Fred Otash.
Mm-hmm.
And he makes an appearance in a couple of James Ellroy's books.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And according to this one Hollywood website that I'm looking at, it looks like there might even be a TV show coming from that.
Hmm. Shakedown?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, he makes an appearance in, I think, Shakedown and The Cold 6000. I've read The Cold 6000. And, yeah, it's a kind of guy. What are some of the things that he did?
Looking at Otash or Pellicano?
Fred Otash was connected to things like the Marilyn Monroe suicide, also Kennedy and Monroe, Rock Hudson.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
You know, getting evidence that he's gay. Yeah. I don't know if it was Otash or his protege who paid like a call girl $1 million after she got pregnant by a Swiss banker.
Oh, wow.
Which you can say is a legal thing to do. I mean, is it bribery? Or it's not like he paid her to break any rules.
Yeah, abortion is legal.
Yeah, I don't know the story. I don't know if that was the deal. It was just like, just go away with this kid. You never bother him. But I suppose that would, what you were suggesting is more final.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Going away is also legal.
Yeah. Going away. Yeah.
No, I said, well, final.
As in,
oh, you mean going away?
The kid's dead. I mean, hey, mm-hmm. if there was a threat in there, like here's $1 million, don't come back. If you do, you know what's going to happen. That could be pretty final too.
Well, yeah, death threats are less legal.
Yeah.
Well, again, depends how like implicit the rest of that sentence is. Here's $1 million.
Sure.
Go away.
Yeah, that's fine. You know, I feel like we're educating you on right or wrong. And I give her a wink.
Wait, so I hit him in the head. That's bad. How about the kneecaps?
Yeah.
Wait, so I don't brandish the knife while I'm saying go away.
And I push a picture of a corpse across the table. Is that...
That was just a knuckles.
Yeah, so those are a few... real ones, and of course, Ray Donovan is a fictional one. And I think I've only watched a couple episodes. In one of the episodes, he used a baseball bat to intimidate somebody physically.
So was that right or wrong? Can I do that?
No? That would be wrong.
All right. Hold on, I gotta write that down.
And then he used blackmail to get somebody to do something.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the person had two families. And he called in the one family on the pretense that they were an agency and they were going to, like, kind of set up the daughter for some sort of modeling or acting gig.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And then took a picture of them for, you know, just to get that on their files. And then emailed that picture to the guy.
Hmm.
And say, we'll tell them the whole story. Or, no, we'll send this picture to your wife.
Right.
unless you do this.
Wow.
You gotta do it.
And I suppose there was some familial resemblance.
I'm sure they would explain who it is and then get, right. provide the details mm-hmm. as well. But
yeah.
I think the picture is more for that guy saying, we have them here.
Right.
So we know your secret.
Right,
man. Gotcha. I know we're talking about playing these as characters, but what a wonderful boogeyman these people would make, too. If you
yeah.
were playing as like a executive or an actor or something, and this person walks into your office, it's like, yeesh.
Yeah.
No, I think they make great NPCs, either as a helpful NPC or as an antagonist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or one who starts out helpful but can turn pretty quickly.
Well, that's...
Yeah, like we talked about, like they'll save the evidence for what they right. need, so you mm. get them to help you in a situation, they'll save that, then you can have them return in a different role.
Right.
The same person, but a different role, and it's like, okay, now I need your help. And, you, and they're like, no, we're going to go do off and do this. No, no, no.
Yeah, it's kind of like...
You heard me.
Yeah, it's kind of like accepting help from the mob, you know? They do you a favor with the implication that, you know, there's going to be a favor later on, and
yeah.
you can't really say no, where, you know, you go to a fixer, who knows what, I mean, part of their job is getting information and tracking people down and getting at people who think they are safe. So you sicking that kind of person on someone else, the fixer has the ability to do that to you. And who knows what they're going to find on you when you ask them to go do this job. So it's a very, you know, double-edged sword. So
I think one of the fixers that I read about, another Hollywood one, is called Eddie Mannix. And I think he was around in the 20s, 30s, 40s, etc. But his big thing was that he was covering up murders. That's what he was supposedly famous for. Of course, a lot of it's only speculation. But one of the other things that was speculated on is that after he covered up the murder, he would keep the evidence of the murder so that he could use that against other people.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you didn't do what he said, then you might have committed a murder by accident.
Mm-hmm. Or on purpose. Because if he was covering up murders...
Actually, yeah. Murder would be involuntary manslaughter.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we've touched on it a bit, but how do you go about being a fixer?
Well, first you need a really cool suit. No?
Yeah, and a fedora, see?
Oh, it wasn't going that all right.
Well, I mean, there is something to that. I mean, how do you do it? One thing is you need to blend in to the surroundings that you're working in, because you want to attract attention. Now, I suppose if you watched like a movie, you want everybody to know that's the fixer.
Right.
Or that's the shady character. So you might exaggerate those things. But if you're going to meet somebody in a dark alley, then I guess it doesn't matter how they dress.
Mm-hmm.
But if somebody's going to come...
I'm now imagining a yellow, bright yellow jumpsuit.
I am the fixer.
Or a trench coat and nothing else.
Yeah.
But if the person has got to go to your office, or you're going to meet them around Capitol Hill, then they need to be dressed like somebody that the person in power could interact with without arousing suspicion.
Mm-hmm.
No, absolutely.
So, yeah, often it would be a suit, or they need to look legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's kind of thing. There's kind of different approaches you could go with this, and what you're saying is absolutely right. Like, if you are going to meet, as a fixer, if you're going to meet someone in you know, certain locations, then yes, you have to look like someone they could legitimately be talking to. So if that means a politician, that would mean a nice suit, as you said. If you were meeting some kind of, you know, Hollywood movie star, that it means, you know, dressing nicely and not looking like a slob so you stand out at that, you know, party. I guess the other option is to be that person who stands out, not like wearing the yellow jumpsuit in the alley, like the joke I made, but... As you said, Lyle, for movie purposes, you know, you want the audience to know that that person is the fixer. But one of the things they use, one of the tools they use, is intimidation. So long as they're intimidating enough, I don't think a lot of people would bother them, and that's another way to go. Or if they're really good at manipulating or finding or hiding information, then, you know, you kind of watch those, you know, spy shows or CSI shows, and certain people just, you can't dig up any information on them. They essentially don't exist in the system. And if you're the type of fixer who is able to do that, then it almost doesn't matter what you look like.
Well, not to undercut what you guys are saying, but in my mind, a fixer would probably be able to look like whatever they need to look like. And their skill set is pretty similar to a detective's. They have to find information and organize clues and things. So I think they'd be skilled at doing, if not undercover, at least blending in with different kinds of situations.
No, but that gets into my point, is they have to look or dress in a certain way that they wouldn't arouse suspicion.
Right. Yeah, they have to look what they have to look like.
But I take, and that's a good way of putting it, because then that gets into what Wayne is talking about. If they need to intimidate somebody, then they have a different motivation in how they want to appear.
Right. I certainly wasn't saying that you couldn't do one or the other. I just think that as opposed to other character types, there is a wide variety of styles or personas that the fixer could have and still be effective at their job. They could even bounce between, a couple of them.
I just think, I think we really hit upon what is the key thing about the appearance of the fixer, is that it's actually really, really important how they look, because it's very much a part of their job.
Mm-hmm.
And it does change. So you really need to think of how they're going to appear at that moment. If you've got the greasy PI, why are they appearing that way? You can say, well, that's who they are, but they're certainly sacrificing certain things to do that. So what is the real motivation? Are they trying to appear unintimidating? Are they appearing, are they wearing that yellow jumpsuit because people are going to look away from that person?
Right.
And they're not going to suspect that the person in the yellow jumpsuit is doing anything but dressing strange.
Or maybe that will draw attention, and whoever they're talking to really doesn't want attention. So intimidation right there.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, I think one of the things that is really interesting about the idea of playing a fixer is that it's a really social character that's not strictly a social character.
Mm.
Because the skills of, like, intimidation and giving a good sales pitch and definitely lying, these things are all really important to get the information and sell it to your clients as well. But you'll still be doing a lot of investigation and probably sneaking around and things like that. And I'm sure there are probably plenty of violent peaks as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, part of the thing that I thought was interesting about the fixer's job is they're essentially the ultimate connection person.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they can be the person who knows how to do detective work to gather the information, or they could be the person who knows absolutely everybody and therefore can find the information out from other people. Of course, finding the information out from other people means other people also know that information. So then that kind of gets back to the intimidation or manipulation factor, where your contacts, you have to be pretty sure, or you have to, air quote, convince them of not giving the information they found out to anybody else, Or you could just be really smart and spin it so that all your little, spiders on this web are feeding you little bits of information and don't see the larger picture of what you're actually doing.
Mm-hmm. Actually bringing that up there about your little spiders on the web, that hackers could make very good fixers as well.
Well, again, I've watched a couple episodes of Ray Donovan, and that's what I'm basing a lot of the ideas for this episode in. But he has a team of people, one of which seems to be pretty technically savvy in terms of, manipulating or enhancing photographs to find out who and where people are, or bugging apartments and then, listening to audio feeds and figuring out who people are and doing stuff like that, or just going on and They haven't said it directly, but the person might be either through contacts or through hacking, getting into like police databases and finding out information on people.
Cool.
So, yeah, again, part of the reason why I like the idea is there's a lot of different ways you can do that, and all of those skills can be in one person, the fixer, or maybe jumping ahead as to how to play them. People could sort of specialize in certain areas if you're doing like a team of fixers.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not as specialized as maybe like Leverage, again, which keeps coming up in our Rogue episodes. But you can specialize a little bit, but everybody still has to have the basic qualities of what a fixer is. Because it seems like they get in trouble a lot, or, they have to be able to, but I don't know. I imagine the fixer has to be kind of tough, you know.
Well, I mean, not necessarily, because, if you're very much behind the scenes and getting blackmail, I mean, you just have to be careful. Like, I think a lot of fixers would end up getting beaten up mm-hmm. because they make those threats. They realize that the person's going to beat them up, but that's all they can do. And they'd be too afraid to go any further because then the information would get out, and then they'd do what they want. But, you know, it's just, that's just something they got to endure.
Yeah, I get punched a lot.
Right, which kind of goes back to the people have to be tough. So,
well, I mean,
if you're going to play a fixer, high constitution.
Sure. Okay. But I think, well, how would you do a fixer in the game, or how do they do it? I think how they do it in real life, I think it would be pretty straightforward. You know, we grasp with the like a bribe.
Mm.
As they pay a significant amount of money, and the person will then do what they want. Blackmail, you find out some information, and you guys talk about, like, a hacker can do that. Old-fashioned is you get some pictures.
Right.
And do that. Or you record them saying something. Donald Sterling, I guess, is a recent example of what can be done with recordings. Mel Gibson is a less recent example, but where, you know, you can destroy a person's career by just releasing these recordings of them saying certain things.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So those are the blackmails. People don't want those to get out. A very, like a classic way to blackmail them is to blackmail them about their sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that would be, if the person's single, how effective that would be these days, but that was certainly something back in the day. Of course, married people are easily blackmailed.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody does something in their past, illegal, you find out about it, or they just do something very embarrassing, find out about it, then that's something that you could use.
Or yeah. Maybe they didn't do anything at all. Maybe you staged the pictures.
Hmm. I'm wondering if that would work, because if the person has absolutely nothing on them, then they would probably say, yeah, go ahead, release them, because anyone digging into that is going to find absolutely nothing.
Well, it could be like a company that's being sued by somebody, and the company knows it didn't do anything wrong, and will win in court, but it's cheaper to actually just pay the person off than to fight in court.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what I said totally depends on the target, you know, like an individual who's done absolutely nothing wrong, but has to maintain a certain reputation. Yeah, then just the allegation of them doing something illegal or them doing whatever could be enough to ruin them. So it wasn't as if I meant anybody and everybody who's innocent is going to, you know, say no. Certain people will cave just because, as Lyle said, it preserves their career or their company or whatever, and it's easier for them to just pay the fixer off rather than risk having that leaked or put out, even if it's fake.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of getting set up as a fixer in a game, I think the first thing you would have to do is secure clients. How you do that could be, I don't know, it could be really interesting to roleplay, or it could not, depending on how the game goes. Maybe just set the person up as, okay, you're already the fixer.
Yeah, no, I think it would be interesting to set up in that, well, if the player knows what to do, if the player or players know what to do, it can be, I mean, we've been in some games where somebody's kind of set up to do something, but they don't do it, because they're not playing out what's going on in your head.
Right.
You know, you just saying that, I would think then, I guess I would blackmail somebody, I blackmail my first client. And get the ball rolling that way, because you can't really put out a shingle saying, Ray Donovan fixer, and then like, oh well, I'm totally going to trust this guy with my secrets, you know, because they have to be very vulnerable to the fixer.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to have a certain degree of trust in
or
this
desperation.
Person.
Desperation, sorry.
Desperation, but yeah, desperation drives you to seek that thing, like that person out. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to go for that particular person.
Mm-hmm.
So where does that trust come in? And it's very much a word of mouth kind of business.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I mean, I suppose if you're playing White Knight Fixer, they see the problem and, you know, it's like, what is it, Royal Pains, where they happen to be at a party and somebody's choking or has a reaction to something and the doctor saves them and now they become a concierge doctor.
Right, exactly.
And that could be done, but I don't know. It's better
to... It feels like a one-shot. I know what you're saying. It's kind of like, well, that was a freak occurrence and, yeah now how do you spin that out into a career? I don't know. But no, what you're saying about the word of mouth being a fixer or setting up a fixer character in the game is very much a collaboration between the GM and the player, because the GM is in charge of all the NPCs, and so they determine who gets news via word of mouth that the character is now a fixer and did a great job on that thing. So if your GM is kind of, you know, not nice, well, then you had one job and your career as a fixer is over because nobody ever finds out about it. So,
yeah. And you certainly, the way you build that initial character is going to be, it's going to rely on certain skills. Or if you're looking at something like World of Darkness, certain merits as well.
I was thinking that, yeah.
Yeah, you're looking at like the streetwise, perhaps fast talk, allies, contacts, those kind of things. If you want to do the more intimidating person, then yeah, you got to have the intimidation. Stealth.
Yeah, larceny, all of those kinds of things.
Yeah. Seems that playing a fixer would be one of the character types who would want to have multiple contacts to use the World of Darkness system. Because looking at that, you put a couple dots into it and you had one thing that you got fairly high. But fixer's a character where you probably would want to have a lot of contacts and they could be at relatively low levels.
Well, yeah, because the problem with the fixer is they can perhaps burn that contact in order to complete a certain job.
Mm.
I mean, you see that in movies and TV shows, and he's like, "I'm done with you. That's it. Give me the film that you have on me." Mm-hmm. And he goes, "This is the last time I help you out," kind of thing. And yeah, I mean, that's the job. I think with a fixer, and we've talked about backstory in a few episodes, and I'm more of a what is it, a front story or a forward story, where once you start to develop your history.
Yeah,
but it'd be very hard to come in, unless you want to play establishing yourself as a fixer, to come in without a backstory, even if you're not a fixer at this point, but to have some sort of history where you can conceivably then quickly pull together these contacts in order to complete this job that's come up and establish yourself as a fixer.
Well, you could do it if there was some kind of resource in-game where, again, to use New World of Darkness, since that's the one we tend to be using, like you have so many points to sink into merits at character creation. If your GM allowed you, I mean, you could just say, I don't really know what my contacts are going to be yet, but I've devoted this chunk of dots to my contacts. And so can I make them up in play and then spend the dots as I make these contacts? That would be one way to do it.
No, sure. Yeah, no, I don't mean to say that you couldn't do that. What I meant to say is, like, did you do time? Is that kind of where you're leaning towards your contacts? Did you go to an Ivy League school? And is that where you can develop your contacts with? Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to have not a 100% firm idea what your character is before you start playing, but a fairly firm idea.
Right.
Is that, are you the ultimate insider and then you've kind of fallen on rough times and are doing this, or that you just actually really love this, or are you the outsider who's working their way in through this?
Yeah.
And because they're the connection, they're the one foot in the shady underworld.
I think the way that you've run contacts in previous World of Darkness games, Lyle, is probably one of the best ways to do this, because you can make a contact so quickly as a fixer. You do one job for somebody. And you mentioned the favor economy before. They owe you, so that person becomes a contact, whether you have the dots experience to spend on dots or not, you know?
Right. No, but I see what Lyle is saying. Like, if you don't show up with a backstory, then the GM's going to be like, okay, please explain why you have this Hollywood star as a contact, the police, you know, someone in the police force as a contact, and the head of this criminal organization as a contact. Because those are some interesting circles you swim in. So.
No, I mean, if you had been a fixer for a little while, then it wouldn't be a surprise that you have those contacts.
Sure,
you only need one contact with a person. But if you're starting out, yes, you're right.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Yeah, after you establish yourself, then you can have contacts all over the place. But if you're just starting, wow, yeah.
Yeah, or maybe that's how you get into the job, you know? You know a lot of different people through whatever kinds of means.
That is possible, yeah.
It'd be cool, but I mean, I'm not saying that they have to come in with pages and pages of backstory. Because certainly that can be very frustrating when you don't use most of those pages.
Yeah.
But kind of have a vague idea, what's your connection? And is the connection Ivy League? And then that explains all of these, but you also have a drug habit.
Right.
And that explains those. You know, that's how you form this, like, link between these two worlds. The starlet, the police officer, the criminal underworld. I mean, I think, was the character that you played, Chris, right? The closeted actor?
That was me.
No, it
is Wayne. Sorry, Wayne. You were the closeted actor, and there you go. You know, I thought you were going against type. So normally I would have thought Wayne, but then I thought, oh, maybe you guys were going. No, not that you're closeted. I'm just saying that that would be something that you would normally play. But yeah, it could be at one of those Hollywood parties, or one of those parties, or at one of those bars, and that's where you would meet those kind of people because you have that one connection. So it has to be something a little unusual, but can combine different walks of life. And I think the time period will certainly dictate that, because if you say, well, I'm closeted nowadays, I mean, that doesn't necessarily explain why you're meeting all of these people, since people are very open now and it's more accepted. So people aren't going to go to this, you know, back alley bar where there's all these ruffians, unless they're into the danger thing. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe that's a motivation we didn't talk about. You like the danger.
Yeah, actually, yeah, the thrill of it.
But yeah, I think backstories can be fun to write, but I think a fixer can actually be really fun to write. Or think of where you are, because, you know, well, I'm a hero, I'm a fighter, and I grew up on a farm, or, you know, somebody came and killed my family, and I'm looking for that person. You're like, oh okay. I mean, when was the last time you read a backstory for that type of character that just blown you away with how original it is?
But then somebody like
a fixer is like, oh yeah, why? How are you a fixer? How does this happen? And we didn't mention them because they're not necessarily typical fixers. And I'm thinking like Littlefinger and Varys in A Song of Ice and Fire, because they're kind of schemers. They're not necessarily, people come to them as if they are fixers in the story, but they have their own agenda. So I don't consider them classic fixers, but their backstories are quite interesting, certainly more interesting than a lot of the characters that they're interacting with. So Varys comes, you know, he's castrated and through some sort of weird magical ritual, and then becomes like a
master of illusion.
Master of disguise. He became a master thief, and now he's the master of secrets in the Seven Kingdoms. And then Littlefinger from a tiny noble house that, and now he's manipulating everybody. So that's certainly more interesting than Ned Stark.
Yeah. Kind of
Or Jon Snow, or.
You know nothing, Jon Snow. You are nothing, Jon Snow.
Yeah.
No, I know what you mean. And any good GM will use a character, or will use a character's backstory in the game. But I see what you mean about a fixer being, a fixer's background would be, I don't know if it's easier to use, but certainly much more prominent, because the people and the contacts you have made in your backstory are going to be the people you're going to go interact with during the game. So as you said, you know, the classic D&D campaign about, great, you know, bandits killed my family, I'm now going off to find them. Great, that's like, you know, your reward at the dangle at the end of a hook to kind of get you to go down along this plot line. GM just kind of said throw out a few crumbs every once in a while to keep you on the trail of this villain. But a fixer, right, those 2, 3, 4 people in your background, those are the people you're going to go try and get information from for not every job, but frequently for whatever jobs you get. So, yeah.
True, yeah.
No, not absolutely. And people are going to write the backstory so that they have a resource that they can continuously go to for the fixer. But when they write a backstory, not in all cases, they could write a mentor or whatever. But like your example, I think, is a very common one. Bandits killed my parents. They're going to go to that just to kill off the bandits.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Finished. And there you go. I can just cross all of this off my character sheet.
Right. Yeah. And hopefully you've done something interesting in your adventuring career, because otherwise just retire that character.
Right.
Yeah, well, it's like Batman. I was like, okay, now Joel Chill's dead. Great. Just cross that off. Well, I'm going to obsess about it for a long time. You do that. That's really fun.
Meanwhile, I'm going to go read this other superhero comic book.
Yeah, when you read some of the Batman stories, when he went back and visited one of his mentors or something that dealt with the people that trained him, that was kind of interesting. Yeah. A Ra's al Ghul becomes a nemesis.
Right.
So.
Just like being a fixer. Burn that bridge and now that person's after you.
they kind of stay in. Yeah. I think bribing can be a very difficult thing to incorporate into a game. And the reason is because it means nothing. It's it's whatever. I think the blackmail seems more tangible, but you go up to NPC X and you say, I'll give you this amount of money. It can be very, very colorless, very bland, because they accept or they don't accept. But
and also, what does it mean when you give away your money? I mean, are you actually counting the bills and the apartment fees that your character has to pay?
Yeah, there's that. I mean, where is this money coming from? Why does the person care about money? Because they're a character that doesn't. They're there for a scene or whatever. Mm. And I think blackmail, if somebody blackmails you, let's look at it from that perspective. You, an NPC fixer, is blackmailing you. Mm-hmm. Why would you respond to that? Because you can see the very tangible reason to respond to it, because, you know, you could end up going to jail or something like that. You can certainly see how it would play out. Within the game, when somebody offers you a certain amount of money, unless you've got some driving motivation that, or some desperate need for money, then there's no reason to accept that bribe unless you, I guess you want to anyway. Like, yeah, I'll do that for that money. So I think when you incorporate those things, you kind of have to set it up. Either like if you have the NPC doing the bribing, then set it up why the players would want money at that particular point in time. And if you flip it, then maybe they know why the NPC would need money if they're trying to bribe that person.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Like, when you started talking about bribing, it can be very colorless, this social interaction. But so can any other social interaction between characters in a game. You know, if you really want to boil it down, you could just have a dice roll, right?
No.
Like whatever skill roll. But a way, and we say this often, like, if you're going to use it in your game, make it matter. So what you said, I completely agree with, Lyle. You, as the GM, would have to set up why this NPC would or would not accept a bribe, but the player, as a fixer, would hopefully do some legwork and dig into this NPC's backstory and find out if they need money, if so, how much, or, you know, use their social skill mechanics to read this person during the interaction and find out if the amount they've offered is, you know, too much, too little. You know, there are things you could do with bribery in a game, but it's going to take work on both the GM and the player's part. But the same goes for blackmail. Like, if the player as a fixer says, great, I want to blackmail that guy, the GM has to come up with something that is going to be blackmail worthy. You know, like, they have to develop some kind of sordid backstory for this NPC, otherwise the player is going to get nothing. But the player also kind of has to be creative, or at least has to be engaged in the story and their character, and say, here's what I'm looking for to blackmail this character, and here's how I'm going to go about trying to find out if they have anything that is going to let me blackmail them. If they just sort of make a roll and say blackmail someone, well, that's not really going to do anything.
Yeah, no, I think it's a really good point. And just to use the bribery example, is that, and the example that we used, the real life example that we used earlier in the episode of the call girl and the Swiss banker, it's like mad money to the Swiss banker. And then it's like, okay, I'll give you like $500,000. No, I'm going to love him and raise him, or raise this baby, him or her. Okay, $1 million. Okay, take it. Great. That's a really, okay, $2 million. Like, that's not a very engaging interaction. So you could also, not only do they need money or not, but then the also think about how the person counters. And we talked about currency as it relates to the fixer. Perhaps the currency is favors. Perhaps the currency is just the power, or, you know, the narcissism, as Wayne said. But same with this person. Maybe they have other things that could entice them. Maybe they need one more meeting with the Swiss banker to say goodbye. And, like, throw that in the face. Like, give them something that the fixer can use, but whether or not it's a wise idea. I mean, that's something that, you know, the more decisions that you give the player, the more interesting it is for them.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And you can drag out that interaction, if it's interesting, if they're enjoying it, and then they have to go back to the Swiss banker. I was like, well, they actually won't take any of your money. What they want is a weekend of your time. And maybe that's a wrong, you know, a wrong thing to do. And perhaps the fixer then maybe cottons onto it and looks into it. But you've suddenly taken this simple transaction of money and ideally heightened it a bit and made it more interesting. And maybe it is just a weekend and they do that, but then everybody's very suspicious and you've got to be wondering.
Yeah, sure. Everybody can use money, but as you said, it could be, to use the example we've been going with the, you know, pregnant woman with the Swiss banker, it could be, we've set up this life for your child if you decide to keep it, right? We've set you up with a house, a job, wherever, so you're going to be taken care of, as opposed to just money. So, and again, doing that, getting that all set up, could be interesting to play. Even if it's just money, I mean, you guys said, well, does the fixture just sit there in the apartment counting bills? Like, whatever target you're trying to bribe could require a lot of money. And where are you going to get that money from? If you just have the cash on hand in a safe in your apartment, okay. But that's going to be pretty boring. You do run the risk of it becoming a series of, you know, quests where you have to get item A and give it to character A to get item B to give to character B. But at least a few times, having to do other jobs or call in other favors just to get enough currency or favors or whatever to bribe this other job could be interesting, at least a few times.
I was going to say that, you know, if the character decides that maybe this one I'm having a difficult time dealing with, I'll just pay this person off, I'll empty out my bank account and do it. I think that's okay to do, especially because then they have to deal with the fact that their bank account is empty.
Right.
They don't have that option for further interactions, so.
Well, I mean, then follow up with that.
Because
I think that's an excellent point, though, because we were discussing it did sound like putting it all before or during, but I think, yeah, you raise a really good point of, or you can put it right afterwards. So they painlessly just give away all their money, and you're like, great, now you need to do this.
Comes the pain.
Yeah, and then you're like, oh, because there are certainly some really good episodes or subplots in Sons of Anarchy, for example, that's all to do with money. They suddenly have a cash crunch and they need to get money. So what do you do? And to play that. And yeah, something where you forced it, where they have to pay all that money, then hopefully you can simulate one of these like Sons of Anarchy subplots.
Yeah.
Well, that wraps up our episode on The Fixer, where we talked about someone who uses blackmail, intimidation, bribery, or just simple persuasion. Or uses the legal system, which apparently means bribing, blackmailing. But
at least
somebody...
in Chris's world, it does.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us again on Idle Red Hands. Check us out online at www.idleredhands.com. Idleredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website, or stream it through iTunes or Stitcher, or download it off of DriveThruRPG. You can plus one us on G+. You can like us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter, or you can join up and talk to us in our forums. Those are at idleredhands.com/forums and are hosted by Happy Jacks. Thank you very much, guys. Or you can send us an email at info@idleredhands.com. Thanks a lot, and see you next time.
Bye.
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 Drive-through RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. Drive-through RPG. The one true source for RPGs. We'll be right back.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.